From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the summer of 1967. Racial tensions were boiling in Rochester. You might know the story of the summer of 1964. Not many know about what followed. For years, journalist Justin Murphy has had a way of uncovering our local history in its most raw, direct forms. That was true in his book, Our Children Are Very Greatly in Danger, School Segregation in Rochester, New York. And it was true in a piece he wrote for the Democrat and Chronicle earlier this summer. Here's part of that piece now. Quote, "It had been 3 years since the uprising of 1964. Whatever lessons Rochester was going to learn should have been learned. And yet when the Eastman Kodak Company asked a consultant for a confidential assessment of race relations in the city in the summer of 1967, the conclusion could not have been grimmer. The hatred of whites by Negroes is matched by the whites' hatred and fear of the Negro," the report read. "Neither race makes any attempt to control or hide its antipathy. The Negro resentment focuses on the Eastman Kodak Company as the prime symbol of the ultimate in white power and oppression." That 34-page draft report, written under the direction of future U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, was intended as a secret document for Kodak executives. It has seldom been cited and never before published in its entirety, resting mostly undisturbed in Moynihan's papers at the Library of Congress. End quote. Justin Murphy's story brings light into a very dark time for our city. It allows us to see more of what local white leaders thought and did about race relations. It takes us inside Kodak, a company that had its own racist past. And it places Rochester in the context of other cities that were dealing with similar issues, like Detroit. Murphy has decided to leave the Democrat and Chronicle for a new job, and it's one that will require his skills at researching and storytelling. He's the new research and communications coordinator for Our Local History, an organization that describes itself as, well, it's the rebranded anti-racist curriculum project dedicated to educating K through 12 teachers, students, and community members about systemic racism. This hour, we asked Justin to come in and talk about his decision to leave a career in newsrooms for one with perhaps similar goals, but a little bit of a different structure. And he's here, Justin Murphy. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Evan.
And Shane Wiegand is co-director of Our Local History. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Your last day at the Democrat and Chronicle is officially tomorrow. How are you feeling about it?
It's bittersweet. I have been in daily journalism for 15 years now, and I have loved just about every minute of it. It's been an incredible way to get to know the community, to have an impact on the community, to develop some skills. But I couldn't be happier about the way that I'm going to be able to apply those skills now. This is something that is an outgrowth not only of my work at the paper, but as you mentioned, my book, and I increasingly saw the need for a way to disseminate this information to inform the way people look at Rochester and the way that people in other places look at their cities. I think that that's really important, and I'm looking forward to dedicating myself to that.
Shane, I know you know Justin well. What does it mean to your organization to bring him on?
I feel like Justin's already been a little bit a part of our organization since the beginning of the research that my students and I were doing. We were talking to Justin. He was sharing interviews and stories with local civil rights leaders with me and my students, and has already played a huge part in helping us build the local history resources and lessons that are being used in schools across the area. So it feels natural, and I couldn't be more excited to have someone as brilliant as Justin joining the team. And I know my co-director, Keisha James, is feeling the same way.
We're going to talk more about what Our Local History has been doing and aims to do. That's really the focus of this hour. I'd be remiss if I didn't just ask you a little bit, Justin, about, first of all, I mean, do you consider yourself still going on a path to do the work of journalism going forward?
Well, I am hoping, apart from my day job with Our Local History, I am hoping to continue writing publicly in various formats, whether that's freelance journalism or other things. I certainly have other long-term projects that I have an eye on. But, in my book, there were three recommendations, and two of them were kind of like political steps that should have been I hoped would be taken to combat segregation. And I can tell you that there has been exactly zero movement on either of them. But the third one was on advancing anti-racist education and kind of more broadly education about our local civil rights history. And that's not exactly journalistic, but I think in the same spirit of bringing things to people's attention in a way that will change the way that, that they maybe live their lives and see their place, I feel like I'm going to be able to carry that through.
Anytime a talented person leaves a newsroom before retirement from the workforce, it is not a good moment for journalism. And I view this as a really important moment for our local history. And I don't think Shane would be offended if I said, I don't think this is a good moment for the Democrat and Chronicle. How do you see it?
Well, I appreciate that to the extent that it means that I've done my job over the 12 years that I've been there. Regular listeners of your show have heard me say my piece about Gannett and the Democrat and Chronicle.
Occasionally.
Largely at your goading.
Occasionally some very memorable quotes. We should have cut a list of them, by the way. That's what we should have done.
I mean, I'm sad. And I want to say, first of all, that I am leaving behind extremely talented, dedicated coworkers who are going to continue to do the work that they're doing and who are going to step up after I've gone. I'm, of course, not the first journalist to leave a newsroom. I'm not irreplaceable. The Democrat and Chronicle is going to continue to do great work, as is WXXI and The Beacon and TV and the other outlets in town. I don't think there's any question that we're going through a transition period in the industry. It's not comfortable for anybody. It wasn't comfortable for us when we went on strike. And I'm looking forward to seeing what it turns into and hopefully continuing to be a part of it.
You have been blunt about Gannett, and I wonder now, leaving, if you're concerned for your colleagues who remain, given the work conditions. I mean, it took a while to reach any kind of an agreement. I don't think people are dancing on rooftops over what you have there. But, I mean, realistically going forward, are you concerned about the well-being of that newsroom?
Well, beside getting a contract, the strike was an incredible force in bringing the reporters and photographers and producers together. I think that we are in a tremendous position to protect and enforce the things that we got in the contract. That being said, we still work for Gannett, which is still subject to the same vices and market forces that it always has been. I'm personally glad that I'm not working for Gannett anymore. I think that it would be hard to imagine a future of the news that revolves around a advertising-driven model like traditional newspapers have been. So I'm concerned for them because they're my friends and because I know that it's hard for them now and it probably isn't going to get easier anytime in the future. But again, I think it's important. This is something that I want to say to them, and this is something I want to say to news consumers in Rochester, is that they are continuing every single day to do really, really impressive and important work. And the last thing I would want is for anybody to take my personal decision to switch careers as like a signal to abandon journalism or think that journalism is gone or anything like that.
Well, I suspect you'll be a subscriber.
I am a subscriber.
Of course.
And I'm a supporter of WXXI, too.
Well, I didn't ask you that. But a subscriber going forward to the Democrat and Chronicle.
Of course.
So the last question on this subject is one that doesn't have an easy answer, but I just kind of want to probe your thoughts on where you are on this. It's the ongoing question of what form does journalism survive in? What is sustainable? And, I want more people to subscribe to newspapers. I want more people to be members of public radio and support newsrooms. All of it. I want all of it. But every day, we all get a day older, and the younger generation of adults is not really accustomed to paying for journalism. It's not part of the daily routine. And I remember, Justin, when I first got into journalism and I was in my, barely out of college, and I was talking to a consultant who said, there has always been this natural evolution of news consumership in which people in their 20s are a little less engaged with their communities, and maybe they don't read the newspaper as much as their parents did, or maybe they don't watch television news or listen to news on the radio. But then they're going to turn 30, they're going to get married, they're going to buy a house, they're going to have a family, and they're going to get more engaged, and then they'll get a subscription, and then they'll do all those things. Well, whatever assumption we had about that evolution, we can set it aside now, because this is a generation that is just not accustomed to paying. I'm not trying to denigrate a whole generation of people. I'm just observing the trends. And when they are in their, first of all, they're getting married later, if at all, they're having smaller families, and they are finding different forms of media to get news in. So, and they're used to not paying for it. So I don't know what we do with that. And as you leave your career at the Democrat and Chronicle, where's your mind on what looks sustainable?
It seems pretty clear to me that the model ought to be something like what museums look like, where they charge admission, and that's important, and they have supporting members, and that's important, and they have events and fundraisers and things like that. But there's also an understanding that that all doesn't pay the bills. Ticket sales don't pay the bills at Jiva. There's an understanding that the value that brings to the community and to our democratic society is more than people are willing to pay directly out of their pockets for that product every day. And so that's got to come from somewhere else. Philanthropy should be an important part of that. And there's a lot of different ideas about what public funding could look like for that, whether it's in the form of tax breaks or anything else. I don't have strong opinions about that, but it's not going to be, again, that you have a garage sale and so you need to send a check for $400 to the Democrat and Chronicle to advertise it. We're done with that. So it's going to be a bumpy road to the next thing, but there is going to be a next thing. I'm confident of that.
Talking to Justin Murphy, Shane Wiegand in studio with us. Shane's the co-director of Our Local History, and Justin is taking a position with them. Tomorrow's his last day at the Democrat and Chronicle. Journalist there for 12 years, and now he moves into a position of research and communications coordinator at Our Local History. I'm glad you mentioned your book's three recommendations. I did want to tie that into some of what Our Local History is going to do. Before we do that, I want you to kind of close the loop on this story that we were telling at the outset here. This piece you wrote this summer about 1967 is one that was new to me, probably new to almost every listener. You want to just describe a little bit more about how you came upon that piece and then what it was like kind of seeing a report then in Moynihan's papers that pretty much no one had really been aware of?
Yeah. So I came across that on a book research trip to the Library of Congress in 2019, actually. And, I think the basics of good archival historical research are the same as in journalism, which is that you need to kind of have your footing and know your way around well enough to develop some useful hunches. And then you need to take the time to follow them, which is sometimes easier said than done. And probably 8 times out of 10, it doesn't really develop into anything terribly important, but sometimes it does. And so this is the case where as I made my plan for going down there, I knew I wanted to look in the Moynihan papers, and there was just a folder that said Simulmatics Rochester Study. And I just thought it was really important because of the unguarded nature of it, the view that it gives on our community, and, to kind of tie it into our work at Our Local History.
Unguarded because the language was so blunt and frankly chilling?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I have to be honest, even the story I wrote, like I could barely fit anything from the, it was a crazy memo to put into writing, whether confidential or not. But it's something that it's worth fitting into our mental framework of what our place is like, of what Rochester is like. And it's not to take that as gospel or any other source as gospel, but that's what I'm really looking forward to is using my time and energy to unearth stuff. And just, you know, like as Shane said, we've been sharing documents for a long time. And what it usually looks like is, here, look at this thing I found. What do you think? And, you know, that's kind of at the heart of the curriculum units, the presentation that our local history does is we all have certain things that we believe and know about our community. Here, look at this thing. What does that make you think?
Yeah, I mean, the timeline on this was remarkable to me because people know Moynihan is a four-term senator, 24 years in the U.S. Senate. I think U.N. ambassador as a diplomat. But, you know, I mean, again, your piece made me kind of go back down the rabbit hole, and I'm reading about his rather controversial 1965 report on race. And so 1964 happens in Rochester, pretty well known. Moynihan is kind of developing, you know, his reputation in various ways. And just briefly tell the story. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it. You should really go back and read Justin's piece, which we'll link to in our show notes, and then you can find the full report. But in 1967, a group comes to Rochester, and, you know, Moynihan's group at the urging of Kodak, right?
Yeah. So Moynihan at this point has sort of developed a reputation as like the preeminent young intellectual in Washington. And a contact of his at Kodak calls and says, we'd like you, we're trying to get our arms around this whole racism thing. And this is at the time that they're grappling with Fight, the organization. And so just like a consultant report. And what he finds is, in brief, that the tension in Rochester is worse than it was in 1964. There's imminent violence, and in particular, he sees that in the black community, Kodak has become the symbol of not just white supremacy, but white disregard for black people in the community and everything that's kind of out of its own sphere. So he says, Kodak tells the police what to do. This is in, they report that in people's minds, Kodak tells the police what to do. Kodak tells the media what to do. Kodak tells city government what to do. And he doesn't necessarily endorse all of these things, but to give this perspective, and I actually talked with one of the original researchers who was on the ground doing it, is a perspective I had not seen before.
Some of the languages, I shudder even, I mean, I read parts of it here. It is chilling. There's predictions of violence, and there's, you know, remarks about how white police officers viewed imminent violence. Again, I don't want to say all white police officers. I'm saying apparently some who spoke to this group were speaking of not only imminent violence, but this idea that a violent outburst might actually bring some tension down and might be a useful thing, which is a hard thing to see in an official report. I mean, it was a terrible time. Shane, what's when you hear this story and you read Justin's reporting on this, what is going through your mind?
As soon as I read it, I immediately took significant excerpts and incorporated it into a presentation that I gave at U of R the next day, because it was perfectly fitting into the next part of the story we're trying to tell at our local history, both in our units for high school students, but also for the workshops that we do that are interactive with local businesses, nonprofits, and faith organizations to help them first understand our local history of redlining, racially restrictive covenants, and the stories of people like Dr. Cooper, Dr. Alice Holloway Young, so many others who I've had the chance to talk with about on this show before. But what people always ask is, well, then what happens after? Yeah. Like, that becomes illegal, and then what? And throughout this last year, Keisha and I and our team have been researching this part of the story. We'd started going through the Joseph Wilson papers. There's 12 huge boxes on the Metropolitan Housing Committee that was formed because of this report. So I immediately made that connection. I hadn't realized how Kodak, who was the number one or two biggest partner and funder of this committee that was chaired by Joseph Wilson, president of Xerox at the time, to literally ameliorate the effects of redlining and to solve a housing crisis that was going on in the community, where business leaders then, just like business leaders today, are saying they're having trouble bringing in new business because they can't find enough housing for their employees because of exclusionary and restrictive suburban zoning. Topics I know we've talked about in the past with Richard Rothstein and others, and that is a feature of our units of study. So I'm seeing this, and it feels like this is some of the missing piece. And so connecting this to the reports, the data, and even this documentary film that this committee produced about housing in Rochester, they didn't follow this report. That was one of the biggest things that stuck out to me. Like, the report explicitly said, I don't think you read this part, but they talked about how the housing shortage is regarded as oppressive by the people in the Red Line 3rd and 7th wards, and it won't be solved just by enabling them to earn more money, since middle-income housing also is in very limited supply, and most of it is restricted. And it goes on to talk about how there's just this incredible mistrust in the community. And so you've got people leading this committee from Xerox, from Kodak, and from the city who have racially restrictive covenants on their home, like Joe Wilson, or who had a policy of not hiring African Americans, like Kodak and Xerox prior to that. And they're running this thing with three non-white people and one white female who are like the tokens on this larger committee of Rochester's biggest business leaders. And it just starts to come together. There's this big, larger story of the smug town, of the arrogance, and this like really good faith effort of people whose minds started to change but couldn't quite take it to the farthest step of saying, we helped create this problem. We're going to own it. And together we need to solve it, and not in this paternalistic way. And we're not done with this research. I think there's a lot more and more to this story. We'll be sharing some of this at the RMAPI Summit in 2 weeks and at the Urban League Interrupting Racism Summit, and starting to work this into the hundreds of groups we've shared with that we hope to go back and help them understand, well, what happened part two and where do you fit into it? Always with this invitation to action that they choose.
I don't want to be too reductive, but I do want to ask you if there is a most important lesson that you hope, when you're educating groups, that they take from this kind of material. Because to me, I can't, you know, kind of get it out of my head what you just said about this idea that the problem that they helped create was now coalescing and becoming clear in front of them, whether it was literally in the form of a report or, you know, what they were learning about their community, how it was impacting others. And it was, in various ways, maybe moving people to start thinking differently. The question is, can you act differently? And they didn't always act differently, you know, even if they thought differently. What lessons do you want people to draw from these kinds of stories?
I think one of the biggest lessons is that how we solve these problems has to be something that's done by together. Both the people at the top, at the middle, and at the bottom have to figure out how to talk to each other. And I think the big missing piece in how these people, and how, as someone who's been a part of many boards and community organizations that do housing justice related work today, like in the past, people are talking over each other and past each other. The number of times I've put my foot in my mouth or said the wrong thing in a board meeting or a community meeting or as part of advocacy in our community that a person from a different background than me took differently than I intended, because we're operating from a different historical context and experience. And that when we brought in some of this history and some of this shared understanding and language and learned how to talk about it with each other, it changed the efficacy of what we were able to do. And I think that's what was missing in a committee like this one in 1968, or a highfalutin report that's coming from Patrick Monahan, is that it wasn't shared with the rest of the community. There wasn't space for us to say together, can we learn from this? Today we have the Raise Commission, we have RMAPI, we have how many big initiatives going on to deal with poverty, with racial inequity, right? And many of them are doing this in a way that's including the community, that's including leadership. And we're there to be that missing piece of how do we ground this in the history that was really missing in the 68 story.
Was there anything in that report, Justin, that shocked you more than other aspects?
There were references in there to specific plans for violence, some of which I don't necessarily believe were true, but kind of the references to the commitment to violence as an ethos. You know, like this is a dangerous period in Rochester and in the rest of the country. So, like, this report predicts a big riot on a given weekend in 1967, and then Moynihan calls the governor, Nelson Rockefeller, and he sends in National Guard troops, and there is not a riot. And so he's like, oh, I earned my money. But the riot in Newark happens immediately after. There's racial violence all over the country. And so from our perspective today, to look back and see how not just protest, but violence from both sides was like really a viable option on the table every day those summers was shocking, kind of.
There's also the way that communities and our stories about ourselves change. We're sitting across the street from Kodak headquarters, and you know, if you're growing up in Rochester now, you know, my son's 12. What does he think of Kodak? Not much. He doesn't think about Kodak much. If you ask him what is Kodak, he might have like this vague idea that it's the film company, or maybe we've talked that it used to be an employer. You know, it used to be a thing. It is barely a thing. People don't think about it. Now, if you are from a family where Kodak was an employer, and that was for tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people over time, Kodak was important, and maybe you view it with some high regard. Maybe you are frustrated with the decisions Kodak made that led to the company's business failure. But it's the part of that report where, you know, the Rochester's black community viewed Kodak in such stark and you know, painful resentment. And if you read Justin's book, then you've got a better sense of why. But do you want to just describe a little bit, Justin, about why by 1967 the black community would look at Kodak like that, and whether the company had earned that reputation?
Sure. From the beginning, from the days of George Eastman, not only Kodak, but other entities in his realm of influence, including the U of R and Strong, had specific policies against hiring black people. They had, out of tens of thousands of employees in 1939, when the state came in and did a study, they had one black employee. Constance Mitchell joked in an interview that if a black person applied for a job at Kodak or Xerox or Bausch & Lomb, they'd put it in file 13, which was the garbage can. And not only the lack of hiring, but kind of the, I think that people saw the deference that these companies were held in, and the power that they had, and the kind of implicit assumption that their path was the correct path for the community, and the community was bound up with Kodak. And they thought, well, if the community is bound up with Kodak and this is how Kodak treats us, then where does that leave us? You know, and as I find myself here in a single bedroom apartment on Joseph Avenue that's been subdivided four times and doesn't have heat in the winter, and Kodak runs everything, then where does that leave me vis-a-vis Kodak?
Kodak was the community. Kodak was the power holder. Yeah. So after we take this only break of the hour, I want to talk to Shane and Justin about what our local history, you know, what they plan to do with it going forward. And if it's an organization that perhaps that name to you, this iteration is maybe new to you, Shane's going to reintroduce it to you so you know exactly what their mission is, where they work, and how you can get in touch if you like. And we'll talk a lot more about our local history with Shane Wiegand, the co-director, Justin Murphy. Tomorrow's his last day at the Democrat and Chronicle as a journalist who's worked for 12 years in this community. Longer if you count time in, I think, Auburn beforehand. So
that's right.
But now moving on to be a research and communications coordinator at Our Local History. We'll come right back on Connections.
I'm Patrick Hoskin, in for Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, it's all things Artisan Works, the unconventional gallery and event space on Blossom Road that blends fine art with kitsch and collectibles. It's long been a vision of its founder, Louis Perticone, who died in July. So what happens now as Artisan Works moves on without him? What does that future look like? We'll talk to the folks inside about that future and celebrate Perticone's legacy. Talk to you on Friday.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So you've heard us talk to Shane about the anti-racist curriculum project in the past. That's what this is, Our Local History. Why the rebrand?
Why the rebrand? For us, we wanted to be more representative of what we're trying to do. We're trying to get communities to own their own local history, to explore it, to have the tools to think about it, to talk about it, to tell the kinds of stories that Justin's been telling for a long time in the local papers, but to amplify and share the stories of often untaught or dismissed stories and to bring them into focus. Our mission is really to support and empower students and communities with the tools to engage with and own their local history of civil rights. And as we expand across New York State into several different regions of the state, we're finding that that name is a better door in for helping people understand here's what we're doing, especially in line with the New York State Culturally Responsive Framework. We've got the tagline, inquiry, equity, and action, which we feel keeps the essence of what we were trying to do before without some of the baggage of some of the language that has been co-opted, I think, by certain people in a maybe not fair or charitable way. Our goal is to make sure that our name helps us and not hurts us to get in front of as many people as possible and isn't associated with agenda. The only agenda we have is to help communities explore and own their local history around systemic racism and civil rights and to decide what that means for them. And that's what we've been trying to get better at. We've been sharing some of our own opinions today, but when we run workshops, we really try hard to make sure that it's people getting to explore stories they've never heard, learn how to talk about it differently than maybe they did around the Sunday night dinner table, and then take action. And our research and our data is showing that when people see it locally, they are taking action around racial justice and equity. And we're helping them think about that, but not telling them what to do.
I'm going to repackage what Shane just said, and you're going to tell me if this is fair.
Please do.
With a name like the Anti-Racist Curriculum Project, there were some people who would not call you back. With a name like Our Local History, more people will call you back and give you a listen. Fair?
Absolutely.
School districts, teachers, administrators, businesses, yeah?
Nothing has changed about what we do, but if sometimes people hear one thing and they close the door. We are all about keeping the door open as wide as possible, and okay, this is helping us do that. And we've seen the change.
And I know you've done this on this program, and I know you have had to do it a lot, but I think, can you do the 30-second version of your own personal story that kind of put you on this path? Because I do think it's remarkable, and I've talked to people who know you well who describe you as one of the more sincere human beings I've ever met. So what started all this for you?
I'm a white guy from Webster who was teaching fourth grade in the Rush Henrietta Central School District when about 10 years ago I had a fourth grade student and their friends start asking, well, did Martin Luther King ever come to Rochester? Did we have a civil rights movement? And after getting angry that I wasn't smart enough to answer that question or think of it myself, I said, we have got to figure that out together. And we dived into the DNC archives on newspapers.com, and we discovered he'd come a couple times. We learned about some of the people whose houses he stayed at, the people whose dinner he had. We went and met those people, like Chuck Price, Dr. Walter Cooper, so many others. And those stories changed my students' life. But it changed my life, meeting those people, hearing those stories. It made me investigate how both of my grandparents had explicitly benefited and been a part of redlining in this community, and that generational wealth it created had benefited me, my college, even the down payment on my home. And I started to realize this was my story to own and to share. And so when my students said, do other kids learn about this? Do adults know about this? And I was like, not really. I didn't. And they said, well, you got to share it. Can we share it together? And that's what we started to do. And in 2020, with Keisha James, an RCSD teacher who got to experience an early version, we were able to launch this at Pathstone. And then now we're over at CCSI, which is allowing us to grow and expand into Buffalo, Syracuse, Binghamton, Westchester, Corning, where we've adapted our local stories with theirs, telling very similar stories and helping kids and thousands of students, teachers, and community members say, wow, more happened here than maybe the myths or some of the parts of the story that have been told before. And we're there to help bring it all together and inspire civic action like it did for me and for my students.
And a little shout out to Keisha, who couldn't be here today, but we've talked to Keisha before. I'm sure we'll talk to Keisha again. You know, Justin, you wrote a book, a remarkably well-received book. Your children are very greatly in danger, school segregation in Rochester, New York. I said on this program, I think it's one of the most important pieces of local history and journalism that I've ever read. My son will be reading it. I hope school students in a lot of places are reading it. In a moment, I want to ask you if they are. But before I do, you know, there are some people who said, wait a second, the most important, one of the more important works about racism in our community is going to be written by a white guy. Are you the one to do that? And now you're going to go over and work for an organization as another white guy. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, I'm a white guy. I have a similar background to Shane. I grew up in Penfield, and you know, in my own path, I kind of came to that same moment. I grew up in a more or less homogenous community with the assumption, the implicit assumption that I was regular. I was default as a white cisgender male. And everybody else had stuff, you know, black people had to deal with racism and women had to deal with sexism, but I didn't have those things because I was just the regular one. And it wasn't until I worked as a reporter and got to go to every corner of the community and meet people there that I realized that I actually exist in context just like everybody else. And those systems affect me just like they affect other people. And writing the book was part of the way that I kind of worked through that and expressed that on my own. The work that we do at Our Local History, I think, you know, Keisha has been obviously extremely important as co-director along with Shane every step of the way, as well as other people that we've worked with. I would say that it's not the appropriate response for a white person in the face of learning about injustice, whether it's on your own or through an Our Local History presentation, is not, oh boy, I better sit down and shut up because, like, my grandpa did some stuff. I own this history. I understand where I fit into it. I'm committed to finding out more. And what can I do in my own life, in my own time, with my own skills? That's what I tell people when, just like at the end of Shane's presentations, at the end of my book talks, the most common questions I get are, I didn't know all this happened. What can I do? And I say, take your skills, take your abilities, continue to learn, and do whatever it is that you can do. I'm the kind of person who is good at going into the library and finding stuff and then writing about it. That's not everybody. There are other people who are good at other things. That's the appropriate response, not just, I'd better stop because I've already done enough damage.
I'm going to compare the work that you're doing in a way to climate change, and here's why. For a time, maybe still today, the person who could be the next president said that climate change recently still doesn't really think it's real. So we're still there. But for the most part, it doesn't matter your politics. You understand the climate is changing. The debate is now, what do you do about that? Like, and there's all kinds of debate about policy, and that's appropriate. There's not any easy single answer that's going to suit every need. In the way that I look at the reaction to sometimes Justin's book or stories about our history, our local history, there's this idea that people say, well, that's not true, or I don't want to hear that because it can be really uncomfortable, or they've heard elsewhere that, well, this is just politics and the quote-unquote political left just wants to make you feel bad about yourself so they can use the government to control your life, and that's really what it's all about, as opposed to saying, like, hey, let's start with really understanding our local history, even where it's painful. And then there's going to be disagreement about what you do about that, how you educate, what you do now, you know, what you feel like you should do personally or not, what you think the government should use, what policy levers or not are appropriate. But at least get that baseline understanding, like, this has happened. What do you do about that is the discussion. And I think if you take Justin's book or you take the work that you're doing, the presentations, the work, the anti-racist curriculum, if more people understand that and don't politicize it, then we can move on to the, okay, so what do we do? As opposed to, like, this isn't real, or this is just overblown or whatever. And I think that would be a healthier place to be. I don't know how close you think we are to being there. And Shane, you've now been doing this work for the better part of a decade. So I want you to tell listeners a little bit what it's been like when you work with, say, teachers, administrators, community groups, whatever, who were maybe really skeptical of you, but somehow you got in the door in the first place. And, you know, they figured you'd be there to shame them or yell at them or just make them try to feel bad. Take us through some of what you've experienced with that.
I think that's a really good question. When I first started doing this work, both with students and community groups, back in 2016, after appearing on your show, people started calling me. And I must have given 50 presentations that year on what I was teaching fourth graders. And I started by giving a lecture about redlining, how bad it was, how we should feel bad about it, and we have to do something. And the people who already were on board said, wow, that's important, that's great. But that's not the audience. The audience is the people who are open, but not necessarily on board with some of these ideas or willing to take action or go to a council meeting or vote or whatever it is, right? And we realized as we started doing this better with kids, we started doing it from a social studies perspective. Inquiry, what do you notice, wonder? What feelings are coming up for you? As Keisha joined the project, her big push was we need to help this connect with how people are feeling. We need to identify, own, and name guilt or shame that comes up at the room, normalize that, help us let go of those things so that we can actually start to not just learn about the bad stuff. And we talked a lot about that with maybe the Kodak example today. But what we started to shift on is that shift with inquiry, with people talking more than we're talking in the presentations. And setting it up so that people are looking at different case studies, just like a group of 11th graders might be looking at we call it a jigsaw activity, like you each have a piece of the jigsaw puzzle, and you learn your story of local civil rights, you study how people resisted, what specific strategies they use, you evaluate it for bias, you think about what worked, what might have not, what you would have done if you were there, and then you teach your group about that. And we've done this with bankers at some of our biggest banks in town, with real estate agents on a monthly basis, and with teachers, with kids. And what we find is that when we do it that way, even the most angry real estate agent who has to do this for their State Fair Housing Credit by the end has been like, oh, this was so different than what I thought it was. I had no idea this happened in my community. I don't know, you know, what I want to do yet about it, but I'm glad I know this. We need to tell the truth about this. Like, the shift is there. Like, our data from our surveys has found it's something like 98% of the over 20,000, 25,000 people who have gone through one of our interactive workshops say they felt positive about it, and they're going to talk to their family about what they learned. And a similar number are saying they're going to actually do something because of the experience. And that shift really happened when we moved from lecture, doom and gloom, you should feel bad, to what do you feel? What do you think? What do you notice and wonder? We try to take our opinion and even personality out of it as much as we can and let the stories from the past, people's own stories, come together and have space to do this in a different way. I was taught growing up, you don't talk about race. You don't talk about racism. We should be colorblind. We should pretend. None of this is there. We can't pretend. We know it's there. Our kids know it's there. Let's talk about it in a different way. And that's the stuff we're starting to learn. And we're going back to places more than once to help them dive deeper, to think, and then look at maybe something like this housing commission from the late 60s. They were really successful with some things, and other things, it was just massive failure. You know, what does a big project like RMAPI or something like the RAISE Commission have to learn from that? We're there to help, not tell them. You asked me to say my lessons, and I could share that. I shared some of those. I want to know what those groups think and be there to make that bridge.
And I think what a really important component of these is that the goal is absolutely not to cancel George Eastman or Nathaniel Rochester or anybody else. And an important part of that is that the lessons and the work focuses not only on the bad stuff that happened, but that at the same time, there's other activity in the community. There are people organizing, even if ultimately not in ways that come to a big victory. For example, Nathaniel Rochester, for most of the history of the city, there was an extremely well-placed belief that he had emancipated people that he owned in slavery when he came to Rochester, and in fact had come to Rochester to New York for the purpose of escaping slavery. That's not true. He brought people with him in slavery, and in fact, as late as December of 1826, just months before slavery was ended in New York, he still owned people in slavery. When he was still in Maryland, he was the sheriff, and he put ads in the newspapers for freedom seekers who had run away from slavery. So, like, okay, Nathaniel Rochester, bad, fine. Another important part of that curriculum is that there are names of people in those ads, and there's one woman who escapes, who seeks her freedom, and he's looking for her. And then a couple years later, her name comes up again, and he's looking for her again, I think, or is it a second time she left?
She got recaptured, but then we find out. So I found that she got captured. But then Justin, check this out a few years ago. And he dives deeper and finds, oh, look, she got recaptured. And then she escapes again and writes a story about it. And now thousands of teachers and students across New York State have learned that story of Agnes's resilience and resistance. That is something that sticks with people. And it tells this larger story about this complex system of enslavement, of economics. The goal is not to villainize or valorize. It's just, how do people, like, create change and do something about it? We're not there. You won't ever hear us in a presentation label a person as a racist or an anti-racist. Instead, we're helping kids think about actions and ideas. Rochester demonstrated racist actions in those moments. We know he did things that were positive in other times. He helped build this city. You get to decide what that means for you. I'll never forget my fourth graders writing to the mayor about how they wanted the name of the city changed. Half of my class did. I had four kids, though, decide they wanted to write. And it was all volunteer to keep the name because they were proud of their city. They didn't like it. They thought maybe a disclaimer should be on some of the signs about what he did. But we should keep the name. And we had a whole big class debate about it. And my job was to just make that space because it's a democracy. We should get to decide what things are named together. And we don't have to agree, right? But we need to have some of the same facts to actually have that conversation. And that's what our work is really about.
So how are people going to find you? Tell me about the goal now going forward for your organization.
Our goal is that every student, teacher, and ultimately community member in Monroe County and all across New York State would have the opportunity to explore some of these same stories that are there in their communities, from enslavement to redlining, and be invited to act and to take decisions for systemic change that creates equity in our communities today. And we want to be the glue that helps hold some of that together with Justin's original research, with our educational skills and what we've been learning and our community partners to really try to uplift that work.
How do they find you?
You can come to ccsi.org/ourlocalhistory. Again, that's ccsi.org/ourlocalhistory. Or you can find us on our collaborative website that we built with the U of R and RIT that's called resistancemapping.org, where all of our resources, lessons, documentaries, and tools can be found for free and engaged with. And you can reach out and invite us to your business, your organization, or your school. In each and every one of those places, we have things to do where we could come back, go deeper, and help people continue
any level, right? You are a fourth grade teacher. It could be high school. It could be any level.
We've been in fourth grade classrooms, second grade classrooms with new units, 11th grade classrooms in LGBTQ civil rights, to the YWCA, to ESL, to M&T Bank, to Canandaigua National Bank, to the local real estate board, to you name it. We have been in some of these places. And there's the need for us to continue to come back, to deepen the conversation, to study the ways people are trying to create change today and say, what do we like? What do we support? And to root it in these local stories. So please reach out to us. We want to help you have a conversation about race and equity and how we solve these problems today that doesn't feel like your dinner table in 2016 at Thanksgiving. Like, that's what we're doing.
Justin, are schools teaching your book?
A lot of the teaching colleges have put it in as part of their research. I don't know that it's specifically on the curriculum in high schools, but I've been gratified by the number of teachers that have taken parts of it, made units out of it, things like that.
About 90 seconds, you mentioned three recommendations that your book carries, and you said kind of humbly that we haven't gotten there yet. What's an example, and what do you think could change maybe with the work that you're going to do with this organization?
Well, the most important one and the underlying one is education. People need to know why we're doing all of this. And I think even more fundamentally, people need to understand where they live and how they came up and how they fit into the whole rest of the thing. We talked about kind of the sad state of journalism, but this is an opportunity, a different opportunity to reach people with that information, to instill that understanding. And that's the precursor for anything. You can't get to the rest of the stuff without people understanding why they're doing it and fundamentally who we all are in this place.
And in the last 30 seconds, Justin, you heard Shane talk about, you know, why the rebrand, making sure you can get in more doors. Are you concerned that there are some people who would reject the message before they even hear it from you?
No, I'm not. Because the message is not white people did bad stuff and we should all hang our heads. The message is not vote for Kamala. The message is we all came from a place with its specific history, both locally and the way that it tied into state and national and international trends. And we should think about that. We should ask questions about that. We should explore resources about that, and we'll all be better off for it.
Thank you both for being here. Justin Murphy for one more day as a reporter at the Democrat and Chronicle, and then officially move solely into the work as a research and communications coordinator at Our Local History. His book is called Your Children Are Very Greatly in Danger, School Segregation in Rochester, New York. We've talked a lot on this program. I suspect we're just going to keep doing that, just maybe a slightly different form. Thanks for being here.
That would be good. Thanks, Evan.
And Shane Wiegand, co-director of Our Local History. In our show notes for this show, when it is posted, we'll share links to the website and more from them. Thank you for being here, Shane.
Thanks so much for having us, Evan.
From the whole team at Connections, Julie, Evan, Rob, Megan, saying thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.